This is PCJ Radio International. PCJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehon.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome again to another edition of your program, Happy Station, from PCJ Radio International. Well, the month of March is only a couple of weeks away, and we actually have some special programs coming up in March that I'm still putting together the list, and I'm not going to reveal anything right away, only on next week's show when we get everything settled. So tune in to find out what we have. We also have some special transmissions beginning in March for Australia, the Pacific, and also some special DRM transmissions to other areas as well. But we'll make all the announcement at the end of the month. Today's program is a bit of a special one because I'm joined on the show by a fantastic composer and pianist from Australia who I first interviewed in 2002 when I was working at China Radio International. He was in Beijing for the Beijing International Jazz Festival, and we spoke for, I think it was like more than an hour. And just a couple of months ago, I said, by the way, Mark, the last time we spoke was more than 10 years ago. I think we should do an update. And he said, by the way, I have a new album coming out, so we're going to coincide it at the same time to discuss the new album and what he has been up to and about, of course, the jazz scene in Australia. Now, it's a fun interview, so we're going to get to it right now. This is the latest from his CD, Resurgence, on your program, Happy Station.
Thank you.
Mark, thank you for joining us today on Jazz for the Asking. I want to begin by asking you a question. I don't know if you've ever been asked this before, but we recently did a poll on the program, and we wanted to find out from listeners, if we said jazz, what countries do they think of? Well, the United States, of course, came out first, followed by Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, even Japan made it on the list. We even had two people that said South Africa, Argentina, Cuba. And oddly enough, Australia was totally, totally ignored.
Well, hello, Keith, and thank you for that provocative leading question. I'm very happy to do my best to talk about it. Well, all I can say is I myself, many of my colleagues, are putting a lot of energy into rectifying that situation. I can't put my finger on it. I do know that a lot of us tour in Southeast Asia. I myself have played the Tokyo Jazz Festival. I've performed many times in Thailand, South Korea. So a lot of us are getting up into Asia. I've also played in Europe. I've played at the Pori Jazz Festival in Finland. I've toured Russia 6 times. I've played in the Baltic States. Many of my colleagues have played a lot in Western Europe and the US. But perhaps it's to do with the record labels. Actually, a colleague of mine once remarked to me that the ECM label, which is such an influential label and has affected all of us with the music it's put out, has signed artists from every continent except for this one, except from Australia and New Zealand. Although quite some years ago, Mike Nock, the Australian New Zealand, originally from New Zealand artist, did do a CD for them about 30 years ago. So I don't know if it's to do with the labels or whatever, but all I can say is there's a host of really, really exciting artists down here doing very, very distinctive music, I think, that is in the tradition on the one hand, but has elements of that distinguish it too.
Well, this leads me to the question then. I mean, when you speak to musicians, let's say from the United States or Canada, you know, they'll say, mm-hmm. I was influenced because I was living in New York and there was this jazz club that I went to and, you know, all the greats were passing through here, Duke Ellington, Count Basie and others. What about Australia?
Well, you're sort of postulating a kind of isolation that is not real. Well, just leave out for a second recordings, which of course bridge all those barriers, and you know you could have assumed that we had access to all the recordings here, which we do. But more to the point, we are on the touring circuit and we go to places. I don't know a single jazz musician in Australia who hasn't lived in New York for a period of time, or at least visited for a few months. We go and live overseas. We live in different places. So the isolation is to some extent putative. I don't think it exists. If there's a little bit, it actually probably has more of a healthy effect, because we have to sort of make our own way and live off our wits slightly more. One thing I'll say is that there's sort of a feeling of, my perception is there's an American sound and a European sound in jazz. That's one thing I would say. It's very, very broad generalization and can be disputed. But I will say that in Australia, I see that the artists are very influenced probably equally by both. We sort of sit in midway between, and that sort of applies to our culture too, because our culture is very influenced by the United States, like just about everywhere else. But we also have a British heritage in terms of our colonial past anyway. So, and we also have a substantial Asian population. So we have a nice sort of a sweet spot. And we're also a multicultural country, like the United States and Canada, which is also, I think, in our favor.
So for yourself then, I mean, who were some of the early influences that you had before you decided to become a musician?
Well, I can't remember the time before I decided to become a musician, because I was so young, you know. But the influences I would have had were my family members, who were professional musicians, both in classical music and jazz music. And incidentally, just so your listeners know, I have a a career that's 50% divided between, roughly 50% divided, I don't measure it, but it's could be said to be approximately 50% divided between classical music, in which I'm a composer and pianist, and jazz, in which I'm a composer and pianist. So I had professional musicians in my family. In fact, my uncle was a very well-known, internationally known jazz guitarist. He performed with Stefan Grappelli. His name was Ike Isaacs, and he would come on tour, and he would bring Joe Pass to the house. And when I was 11 years old, I sat and played in my parents' house, just informally jamming with Joe Pass. So things like that happened in my life. He knew George Benson very well. But then my other uncle was with the London Symphony Orchestra and Yehudi Menuhin's Festival Orchestra. Family's from London originally. And he would come on tour, and I would meet those kind of people and hear that kind of music and play with my uncle. I play with both uncles. One minute I'd be playing All the Things You Are with my jazz uncle, and then my classical uncle would butter in with his violin and say, come on, we're doing some Beethoven now, enough of that. And I'd have to sight read some Beethoven with him. So that's the sort of background I had.
But it's interesting. It's interesting that you say that, because if you look at maybe the last 60 years or even longer, there are so many elements of classical music that are in jazz. I mean, if we take, for example, one of my personal favorite composers of the 20th century, Duke Ellington. So many of his works are considered extremely classical.
Absolutely, but more to the point, I think these forms of music are closer than people imagine. For example, if you can put yourself, and I'm not an expert in non-Western music, but if you look at Western music from a non-Western perspective, you will see two forms of music that are pretty much very close to, you'll see more in common, because they're both based on functional harmony, chromatic harmony, particularly in the harmonic content, obviously in the instrumentation, although there are some differences, but there's a huge overlap in the instrumentation. The presence of improvisation is cited as a huge distance between them. But of course, the disappearance of improvisation from classical music is a very recent phenomenon anyway, and it doesn't hold for the whole history of classical music at all. And more to the point, most of the classical players, classical composers, you know, of the past, the great ones, especially the pianist composers like Rachmaninoff and Schumann and Chopin, were to an extent just codifying their improvisations on paper in not too dissimilar a way to the way a jazz musician would sort of preserve their improvisations in aspic on a recording on an album. So I don't see these forms. I see these forms as naturally. I see them as much the same thing, although there are differences. So I'm very comfortable in both worlds. And if you're going to talk exclusively about jazz, I have many of the usual idols. Maybe some you don't know because they're players who are around me that weren't internationally known. I think most musicians must be honest and say that they're also influenced as a kid by people that nobody'd ever heard of who happened to be living in their town. Great players that, you know, that go unknown. But the idols I have are the polymaths, you know, like Keith Jarrett and Andre Previn and George Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein, who really just move very freely between those two worlds. Even the film composer John Williams, in whom I hear, who influenced my recent symphony that was premiered. I wrote my first symphony this year, and that was premiered a few weeks ago. And in the last movie, there's a little bit of an influence of John Williams in his film music. And, you know, it's a sort of a late 20th century form of orchestral music that really struck me and many people on the planet as an exciting rejuvenation of the orchestral tradition. And the way it was rejuvenated, it was because of not only was he deeply knowledge of the classical tradition, he is Johnny Williams, the jazz pianist, who you'll find on many vintage recordings from the 1950s, even into the early 1960s, where he was a well-known jazz pianist. I don't know if you know that about John Williams.
Well, you know, something that I found out about John Williams recently, back in the late 1960s, he was also a freelance composer for television and everything else. And
yes,
he actually wrote quite a bit of the incidental music that was on Gilligan's Island.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me. The one I used to watch when I was a kid that had amazing orchestral music. I don't think Gilligan's Island had amazing orchestral music. The one that did was the science fiction series called Lost in Space.
Right.
In which you can hear a full symphony orchestra playing wonderful music.
So, you know, the last time we spoke, which was about more than 10 years ago, was in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And I recently contacted you because I said, you know, we've been playing an album that we have of you. We have two. The one we've been playing a lot of is called On Reflection, and you said it came out 17 years ago.
Yes.
We do have the new one here. How do you enjoy as an artist working in a studio? I mean, I hear quite often from jazz musicians, they say they like it because they can, you know, control the sound. They can control the feeling and the mood that they're trying to get across. But they say there's something about performing live that they can really change it and bring it to a different level that cannot be captured on CD.
Yes, look, it swings and roundabouts, pluses and minuses. I love the studio because of... It's like sculpting. You're like a sculptor. You can shape what you want to do. You can do another take in the mix. You can enhance elements that you want to bring to the front. That you want to show the listener. You want to show the, you know, bring that to the front. You know, direct their attention. Just like you might frame a painting or light a painting in a gallery, such that it shows off the painting to its best effect. So I love that aspect of the studio. As a player, yes, it's often difficult to get the live energy that you get, that the audience gives you, you know, a buzzing, crackling audience. There's an element of risk-taking too. It takes a lot of courage to take risks in the studio. On the other hand, the studio can allow for a sort of a very beautiful... You can make the negatives a positive. So the studio allows you to produce a very sort of contained concept album. I think... If you think of I mentioned the ECM label earlier, really, the sound of an ECM recording is a studio sound. Now people will go out and make that sound live. But that sound, I think, in many respects, was first created in the studio. Its control and its use of dynamics and a sort of a chamber music element to jazz. You know, I mean, it wasn't a case of bringing something that was existing live in clubs and bringing it into the studio and trying as best to make it feel like you're in a club. With an ECM album, you tend to feel like, you know, you're in the studio and it's been beautifully produced. And then people, I think it goes the other way. Then they go out and do performances and they create that sound live. So, you know, the control, the coolness, if you like, of the studio, inherent coolness mostly, can be used to your advantage. And you can get a very crafted concept. Perhaps live can have great energy. It could also be slightly warts and all too. You know, I'm just sort of arguing the toss here, but I love both. They're like two children, you know, if you like. And you say the strengths of one are great and the weaknesses also make them what they are too, you know, so you wouldn't want it any other way. So different. And I've explored this with my band. You're going to play the new album I sent you. It's from my Resurgence band. We've done studio albums and live albums, and I released a studio album with a DVD of the previous live album, which was a concert, live concert that was recorded, but at the time we didn't release the pictures, but it was filmed for video. And so in the one package you had a document of a live thing and a studio thing, and they were different, you know, and that's okay too. I don't have a preference, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
When you're
Except that I wouldn't want to be in the studio all the time, not performing live.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, but of course, there's also before you sort of I in my long-winded epistle, I will say that there's a meeting point, and that is a live recording, which is sort of can be the best of both worlds, where you do because when you're performing live, you can forget that you're being recorded, and then you say, "Wow, that was recorded. I forgot." You know, so a live recording is sort of the meeting place of those two things.
When you're working on new material or a new CD, do you try to, I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, if we take, let's say, Oscar Peterson, you hear an Oscar Peterson recording, you know it's an Oscar Peterson recording. Other musicians that come along, let's say like Chick Corea, you know, Chick Corea has gone through different stages. He tries to create different sounds for depending on what he's going through at the time. Do you work that way, or do you try to keep, well, I'm Mark Isaacs, I'm going to do it this way, or do you want to always do something very different every time?
It's an interesting question because I think that there's no straight answer to that question. I don't think the artists you mentioned and the artists that I would admire, I don't believe, and I don't do this, would consciously say, I'm going to do something different. When it is different, it just reflects what their life is doing right now. It might reflect the musicians that they're currently with. And so in one sense, I could say I've done very different things, especially if you look at classical to jazz. But probably it's all me. Not probably, it definitely is all me. But I can't really say what the elements are that make it me. Look, I think about it just as a human being. I'm a person who goes to the supermarket. I go on a holiday with my wife. I drive my car. They're all very different things. And I probably do all those things in a way that somebody could say, see, you know, it's the same personality doing all those different things. And I guess my music, most people's music would be like that. It's the same person, the same being doing things that are clothed outwardly in different ways. Now, sometimes a change of direction could be a conscious step. I mean, you could say, I really need to, this band has run its course, I would like to form a new band. I mean, sure, it can be a really conscious thing, but sometimes it's just, for me, it's more just a case of doing the next thing, you know. The people around me, you know, I've got a singer in my band now, I'm writing lyrics. I think I'm writing lyrics because I've got a singer in my band. I thought, why the hell not? I love words. But then I ran into another singer, and I thought she would be great to sing some backing vocals, maybe even do a duet with the singer, but it's because I just ran into her. And so it's a little bit of happenstance in there. It's not as contrived as perhaps a certain element of your question mm-hmm. might have suggested.
Well, for example, when you're writing something, do you write I mean, of course, not just for yourself, but I mean, do you write, if you think, okay, this is my drummer, this is my bassist, this is my guitarist, I'm going to write for these musicians.
Well, you have their sound in your mind. That goes without saying. In jazz, I think that's very true, because in classical music, because I'm a composer in classical music, you're writing a flute sonata or a symphony. You're writing it so it could be played by any orchestra on the planet or any sufficiently competent flautist or whatever. So you tend not to think about individual players. I suppose if you're writing for a famous orchestra, it's possible you might have the sound of that orchestra in your head. It's not that common. But whereas in jazz, if you have a band, you do think of the players in your band, and yeah, there's to a certain extent you write for them. But my writing's influenced too. Look, if I get commissioned to write a string quartet, then suddenly I'm thinking of the world of string quartet music. Until that point where I was asked to write a string quartet, my writing wasn't going to come out in that particular outward form, because it was not the stage wasn't set for it, I suppose. So, but there is a great, and you mentioned Duke Ellington. I mean, that's a classic example of music written for that band and that band alone. So it is a very exciting dynamic in jazz that the composer, what it is actually the composer has their own ensemble, which is not that common in classical music. It does exist. You know, there's a Philip Glass band that goes around and plays his music. So it's not unheard of in classical music, but it's not as common. Composers and performers are sort of separated, and even though composers might be commissioned to write a piece for a particular performer and may well have that performer somewhat in mind, in the big picture, they're probably trying to add to the repertoire of violin music as an ongoing thing, because they're in a way they're thinking about that legacy, that sort of canonic aspect of trying to write music that violinists 100 years from now will be playing. We all want to do that.
Thank you.
the new album, or even your past albums, how much time do you spend on them? Is it something that you just sort of sit down one day, okay, I'm going to write this whole thing, or is it done over a period of maybe a year or even 2 years?
I've done both. I mean, this new album, I actually wrote the album. I sat down to write the album, and I spent, you know, a good part of a month doing that, and then rehearsing it and recording it. But in the past, and this is possibly more common, not just for me, but for most jazz artists, is that over time I wrote a bunch of tunes, and then when I came to do an album, I sort of looked through what I'd written over the last couple of years and tried to put them together in a meaningful way and in a meaningful order, because I still think about albums as sometimes hopefully being listened to as entities from beginning to end. The good thing about writing the album was that I could actually compose it that way, as if it was I can't remember how many tracks it's got, but as if it was an 8 or 9 movement suite. You know, it was sort of crafted as a sort of as a composition from the beginning to the end, and that's probably not that common in jazz to do that. You know, even the singer-songwriter world or the songwriting world, one would tend to just sort of gradually build up a collection of songs, and when you come to do an album, and then you just try and put them together so they flow well, as if the album was conceived from the very beginning that way. But I would say quite often it's not. But it is fun to do it that way. I love doing that.
A number of years ago, I interviewed a Dutch composer and musician by the name of Harry de Groot, and I asked him, I said, what is the oddest album that you've ever recorded? And he talked about one that he did back in the 60s where he said... he told me, he said he was quite lazy. He didn't like sitting down and composing stuff. So he hired the studio, hired the musicians, and he basically composed the whole album on a fly. And it came to a point when the album was released and there were some other musicians that wanted to perform some of the works on it. And they were contacting him saying, do you have anything on paper? And he went, oh, paper you want.
Well, it's a testament to him that it sounded like it was composed, because, you know, I did one particular album a long time ago in New York when I was about 30 in 1988. Actually, it's been reissued about a few weeks ago. And I did that in New York with Dave Holland and Roy Haynes, of course, two very, very famous players. And I put it together with the concept of just assembling in the studio and improvising freely. And we didn't even rehearse. We didn't even sound check together. We just rolled the tape and played. But I don't think anybody will ask for the music, because I think it sounds, even though it's quite melodic, it's not particularly, doesn't exhibit that sort of frenetic, impenetrable quality that a lot of free music does. It's quite melodic, but it probably doesn't sound composed. Maybe one track. A couple of tracks came out like they could be composed. So perhaps someone might say, can I see the chart for that? And I would have that same dilemma and have to explain to them that it was created on the fly in the studio. Jazz is fantastic that it allows for that sort of thing. Even though sometimes in jazz I do write things out and arrange them quite carefully, I also love, you know, I mean, I did a gig in Auckland, New Zealand a few weeks ago where I didn't know the bass player or the drummer. We hadn't played together and we met half an hour before. Of course, it was based on standards, but I just called standards and play them, and the music is assembled instantly. I love that about jazz.
Let's talk about some of the players that you have on this new album. Are these musicians that you've worked with before?
Oh, yes. The guitarist, James Muller, is actually on the album you mentioned from 17 years ago. So he goes back the longest. He's been with me since the mid-90s, or about 1997. The others I've been working with... for 7 years or so, since 2007, with the exception of the vocalist who came on board about a year ago at the time that album was recorded. So that's where that's at. And they're all, you know, very distinguished musicians in their own right in Australia, and the guitarist and the James Muller, and the saxophone player Matt Keegan, and the singer Brianna Callishaw, all release albums under their own names, and we'll have a collection of albums in some cases under their own names.
And the album is it only distributed in Australia, or is it also available worldwide?
It's distributed in Australia and Japan. I have a Japanese distributor. It's on my label, and I have a Japanese distributor for my label, Disc Union, and but it's also here. And but you know, I suppose it's distributed worldwide because of the internet. You could argue because it's on iTunes, it's on Amazon. So really, these sort of platforms these days. I mean, I suppose physical distribution, but even physical distribution, you only have to. It's only a few clicks away as well. So the territory. I suppose, you know, it's changed a lot in that respect, hasn't it? It's good. But, yeah, strictly speaking, I have a distributor in Japan only, an actual distributor relationship.
Mm. Well, I discovered this past week, we have a very famous bookshop chain here in Taiwan called S-Lite. And they do have probably one of the largest music selections available in Taiwan. You name it, they have it in practically every format, from vinyl to CD. And they did have three of your albums, including the new one, at their main flagship store in downtown.
Oh, that's terrific. Including Duende. I'm pleased to hear it.
Yeah, it was imported from Japan with the Japanese price.
yeah, well, that was probably from Disc Union. So I'm really happy about that. That's good to know. It's funny. It's always great to see your stuff around the place. I remember once, I think we were in Bangkok, Thailand, and we went to the markets, and there were a lot of pirated albums there. I think at the time, anyway, I don't think Thailand was a signatory to the International Copyright Convention, so there were sort of $1 and $2 albums all over the place. And but my music wasn't there, and I was disappointed. And somebody said, "Oh, you're disappointed you're not being stolen from." And I said, "Yeah, well, it's flattering."
Well, you're gonna find this really odd. This happened to me about 9 or 10 years ago, when I was doing this a jazz show in China. I was traveling in southern China, in Guangzhou, and I went to some market, and I found these CDs that were in this marketplace, and it had the name of the show that I was doing. And I went, what? And the name of the radio station on it and everything. And I'm like, this is too ridiculous. So I ended up buying one, and what they had done, they recorded the music off air, cut my voice out.
And released it. That's crazy. It all gets it out there. You know, like, I mean, we've been sort of, I'm not too upset about piracy because, you know, I remember in the 70s, we musicians would record albums from vinyl to cassette, and I'll give you a copy of that. I'll tape it for you, you know. And so it's been around a long time. And
well, Canadian jazz vocalist that I spoke to, his albums are mainly only available in Canada and the United States. And when he was traveling in Southeast Asia, he found pirated copies on the market, in the marketplaces. And I asked him, I said, how do you feel about that? And he says, well, in all honesty, he said, actually, it's okay because it means my music is available here. It may not be done through our record label, but people are buying it.
That's right. I mean,
people are getting to know me.
You have to weigh that. You have to weigh that up. Yeah. Well, we all trying to get our voices heard in the global marketplace, that's for sure.
Mm. Before we go, if you had to choose one track from your new album, what would it be? And we'll play this out for you today.
Well, I would suggest one, that's a tough call, but probably the one I would point people towards would be the second track, You Never Forget Love, either as the second track or the final track is an extended version of that, and you can make your choice, because the reason I made a shorter version was for radio, but perhaps on your program, the longer version would be acceptable. So the track You Never Forget Love, in either is extended mix, as I called it, or its shorter form, which appears as the second track, mainly because I'm very excited about my brand new singer. She does sing elsewhere in the album, but as wordless vocals. You know, vocalese, as it's called. But on this track, she sings lyrics. I wrote the lyrics, and I'd suggest that one.
Mark Isaacs, thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you, Keith. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Let love be lone in the darkest night. There is your song. Don't wait. Now's the only time that's real. Will you throw it all? Someone's heart, you go to ground. The way of life. You never forget love and understand this. You're not. Love is your name. Be the child that knows no other game. Don't wait. Now's the only time that's real. Will you throw it all away? Would you? Disguise, only minds will change. Love never.
That's a track taken from Mark Isaac's latest CD, Resurgence. Now, if you're saying to yourself, Keith, why do you sound different now than during the interview? Well, there is a good reason for that. When I spoke to him, it was in Australia, and they're 4 hours ahead of us, and he was only able to do the interview in the morning, mid-morning, which is around, I think it was around 9 or 9.30, which was around 5.30 in the morning for me. And I'd just woken up, had 2 cups of coffee, but it didn't really make much of a difference. Anyway, we're going to leave you right now. And, well, we'll see you next week. Hope you enjoyed the show. We're going to close today with Sixto Rodriguez, otherwise known as the Sugar Man, with the Establishment Blues. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Mayor hides the crime rates, councilwoman hesitates, public gets irate, but forgets to vote dates, weatherman complaining, predicted sun it's raining, everyone's protesting, boyfriend keeps suggesting, you're not like all of the rest, garbage ain't collected, women ain't protected, politicians using, people they're abusing, the mafia's getting bigger, like pollution in the river, and you tell me that this is where it's at. Woke out this morning with an ache in my head, I splashed on my clothes as I spilled out of bed, I opened the window to listen to the news, but all I heard was the establishment's blues. Gun sales are soaring, housewives find life boring, divorce the only answer, smoking causes cancer, the system's gonna fall soon, to an angry young tune, and that's a concrete cold fact. The Pope digs population, freedom from taxation, teeny bops are uptight, drinking at a stoplight, miniskirt is flirting, I can't stop so I'm hurting, spinster sells her hopeless chest. Adultery plays the kitchen, bigot cops on fiction, the little man gets shafted, sons and money's drafted, living by a timepiece, new war in the Far East, can you pass a Rorschach test? It's a hassle, it's an educated guess, well frankly I couldn't care less.